Hi, I'm Patrick Campion, Program Director at 89.1 WEMU, your community NPR station, and a proud part of the Eastern Michigan University campus, academic community, whatever you'd like to call it. We really love our home here in Ypsilanti on the campus of EMU, and we've brought a couple of distinguished Eastern people along with us for the ride today, and they've just come back from far, far away, and they've flown in today to come visit with us, and boy, are their arms tired. Hey, see, they've got a sense of humor, so that's great. Sitting in front of me, to my right, your left on the radio dial, is Val, a student here at Eastern Michigan. These are very informal introductions here. And then Dr. Ali, welcome. Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good evening. Good night. Wherever you might be listening to this today. And we're going to be talking informally today about a trip that they took. So, Dr. Ali, why don't you introduce yourself and introduce Val a little bit here and just talk about what we're going to be talking about for a little bit.
Oh, okay. So my name is Sadaf Ali. I am a professor, assistant professor of electronic media and the Department of Communication, Media, and Theater Arts at Eastern. And I brought one of my students with me. Her name is Valerie Hopkins, and she attended a study abroad course that I taught this past month, I guess, in London. I taught this course called Journalism and Social Media in London, and Valerie was one of the students that attended, and we got to learn all about media and social media and how it all works in this dynamic city, in the dynamic city of London.
And Val, what was your inspiration to jump at this and go, hey, I really want to do this?
Well, it was actually a funny story because I applied for one of the study abroad programs before this. It was the Italy trip, and I unfortunately got rejected from that. And I was so bummed out thinking, you know, I did something wrong, but the professor just wanted to take all of his seniors. So there was a few options still left for me to go, and I looked at the social media one, and I realized this is so much more relevant to my major and what I'm interested in, and it just worked out so much better, and I got to go to the London trip.
So, we want to hear a little bit more about the trip, but first let's learn a little bit more about you, Val. How long have you been here at Eastern, and what's your focus of study here?
I've been here for 2 years, and my focus of study is communications, minor in psychology, and I may have room for other activities too.
And sorry for the cliche phrase, but what do you want to be when you grow up?
That's a good question. ask me in 5 years.
Right. You're just keeping the door open for now?
Oh, yeah.
So what interested you about communications in the first place? I mean, what is it of that realm? Because that's a pretty big world.
Yeah.
What is it that interests you there?
Well, the fact that we need communication to survive, we need to understand each other at very basic levels as well as intimate levels. And so you have to learn the balance between communicating well, listening well. I think those are just really important factors to have, like, every day.
Well, good tools for success in almost every aspect of
life.
So, Dr. Ali, what inspired you to create this new program that you wanted to bring to students?
Well, part of the reason was I felt like our students don't have enough opportunities to travel abroad. And, you know, it depends on what kind of school you go to. Certain schools have students that have just the access to be able to go abroad and go to different countries. And I thought, you know, this is a much more safer way to get students across. I mean, sometimes students may not want to travel because they just don't know what to do. They don't know where to go. They don't know anyone. So I thought if I put it in the context of a course, for a lot of students, that just seems like a safer route. And I chose London because it's the number one study abroad destination. There isn't a language barrier. There isn't really a major culture shock. Not really. I mean, there's a little bit, but not as much. And for most students, it's just a safer place. If I'm going to travel, the first place I want to travel to is probably somewhere in England.
And have you been there before?
I had been there before for a conference.
So you felt a little more comfortable.
A little bit. And I just fell in love with the city. So it was something that I wanted to do again.
Well, let's talk about the nitty gritty of the process. I mean, how does something like this happen at a school like Eastern? I mean, you had a great idea. So how does it go from idea to actually getting on a plane and going over to England?
Well, I brought the idea up to another faculty person in my department who mentioned that he was the one that he does the Italy trip, the film in Italy trip, and it was Henry Aldridge. And he said, you know, you should speak to Benita Goldman. She runs the study abroad program, and she would love to be able to take more faculty overseas with students that just don't have enough interest, or they're not seeing enough faculty wanting to do it. And I said, well, I want to do it. So, yeah, I'll go.
Take on the challenge.
So I just contacted her, and she was like, yeah, I mean, this is a great program. We could do this. I mean, my area of research is journalism and social media. So just felt like those two, it all fits. Yeah. It all comes together. So
is it one of those things that if you have enough students interested, they're just okay with it because it kind of funds itself at that point?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. She wanted there to be at least 20 students, but unfortunately, we got down to about 10. And that was the minimum amount we needed.
I'm glad I made it.
Yeah, you made it in. Yeah.
That's a manageable group, though.
It is a manageable group. I think 20 is a little bit rougher.
Right. I definitely think it would have been too excessive with 20. Yeah. Like, just walking around and getting place to place, it was very busy.
It's a busy city. Yeah. I mean, I think that with 20, it would have been too much anyway. But 10 was enough. It self-funded itself. There was enough money to handle things like high tea and tickets to things. And so, of course, the students had to pay for tuition and the program fee. But there was enough that came together that they were able to handle it.
I mean,
it.
Think about the one show that we got invited to. If we had a bigger group, they probably wouldn't have wanted.
They wouldn't have let us in. Yeah. There wasn't enough space in the studio for a show like that.
Right.
So we'll circle back around to this because I want to ask you how you started and where you ended up. When you were formulating the idea for this trip, what were your goals for you and for the students?
So the goal was that I wanted students, especially journalism students, to have an idea of how media, broadcast media, traditional media functions in a city like London. I mean, they're used to seeing it in the context of the United States, but let's talk about it, how it happens in another Western country. So, and I also wanted to look at how a lot of these news organizations, most of them actually, even in the U.S., are starting to utilize user-generated content within their material. And so that was an important aspect of it. I mean, I do research on the Arab Spring and how Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and YouTube have sort of contributed to these, uprisings. And I thought, well, why shouldn't students get a chance to see that in the context of traditional media in London?
And Val, when you heard about this, what was your goal going into the trip?
Well, looking at the topic, I think it's very relevant to us. It's like what we're doing in society, like as a culture, we want to be online. We want to connect with other people through social media. And we're also dealing with a transition from like an old source of media to a new source of media. And we have to find out, what was happening in that era versus this era, what's changing, what's not.
And I'm curious, in the days leading up to the departure, I mean, did you have a nervous moment? Did you have like a time where both, this can go to either one of you, Dr. Ali or Val, did you have moments where you're like, I just don't know what's going to happen here?
I mean, anytime you're getting on a plane, there's always those moments of like, okay, I just want to make sure everyone shows up on time, no one misses their flight.
Yeah.
I'm a person of color, so traveling in airports kind of makes me just teensy bit nervous. Mm. So I just wanted to make sure that, I wouldn't have any issues. I mean, my last name, Ali, is a pretty, it's one of those names.
A common name, let's just say.
A common name, let's just call it that. Yes. And so I just wanted to make sure that we were all together, that we were all safe. I've had some students in the class that had never flown before. Mm. So there was a few that were sort of like, oh my God, what's a plane like?
I'm surprised. Like Princess, she handled it very well, I think.
Oh yeah, she was a trooper,
and
actually.
And I've flown many times, but I was so nervous before because it was an 9-hour flight. Right. We had to change from Paris to London. It was just time change. As soon as we got off the plane, it's morning. So we are out the door, ready to go.
And this was timing-wise, how close were you to the attacks in Brussels?
We just went in April. So when were the attacks in Brussels?
Not that long before, maybe
a month ago? Was it March?
Did that play into the conversation at all about how you were going to handle the trip? I mean, was there any atmosphere of uncertainty there?
And just staying together, making sure we were in contact with each other at all times, knew where everyone was.
Well, I want to use that to kind of jump into the cultural differences part of this conversation. And I think that safety and security is something that we take for granted a lot more in the U.S. So was there a bit of culture shock when you got to Europe and then eventually ended up in the UK? I mean, in the differences of how they handled just day-to-day getting around? I mean, was there things that you ran into that you just don't see in America? I mean, what were the first things you started to notice as you got over there?
I felt more seriousness with security as soon as we got off the plane. Like, we had to go check our, we had a slip of paper.
We had to go through customs, and I mean, for people who don't fly regularly, the whole customs things can be a little bit of a...
Yeah, and it was very detailed questions of what you're doing, where you're going. So right away, they're just concerned about what you're doing.
Yeah, when we arrived in England, too, because we were at Heathrow Airport, and he hadn't stamped my passport yet, and so he was like, so what are you doing here? And I'm like, well, I'm here for a course, and we're here for 8 days, and he's like, well, what's the point of it? And I'm like, okay, it's a class, and we need to actually... go to the class. So he just sort of seemed like he didn't really seem to get it. Also, we got a lot of people kind of, whenever anybody would ask me, like, are you guys all one group? They sort of looked at us kind of funny. So I don't know if it was because we weren't there for an entire semester or because it was only 8 days. I don't know what the deal was. But there was a couple people that seemed kind of, in the airport, a little bit odd about, this is a study abroad course?
And so were people, do you think people immediately tagged you as, okay, this is a group of Americans?
Maybe in the airport they did. We didn't get too much of the American thing very often. Like when we were out and about, I don't think very many people said anything to us. But Ida Goldman, who's the psych coordinator, had mentioned just, you know, when you're out and about, don't wear like a lot of American paraphernalia, like, you know, the Eastern shirts or, you know, American flag pants. I mean, not that anybody would. And avoid the fanny packs and the white gym shoes, which everyone did. We were all really good travelers.
We did good.
But, you know, she really wanted to really emphasize that don't let them know how American you are.
Just
because
blend
there
in.
Could be, yes,
because
blend
we don't
in.
Want to stand out and cause like a attention towards us. We want to just see the sights like everyone.
All right, so you're there now and you're blending in.
Yeah.
So you're there.
your
group of 10 students. Was it just you, Dr. Ali? Did you have another?
So we had a psych coordinator. So the first 4 days was Benita Goldman.
Okay.
And then after that, we got Jeremy Baldwin, who works here at WEMU.
Yeah.
So he was
we
the
know
last
Jeremy.
4 days. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So both of them were awesome. But yeah, we had a psych coordinator. And the reason being is that I've never traveled with a group of students. This is my first experience with study abroad, too. And I didn't necessarily feel comfortable just by myself with a bunch of students, and I thought it would be nice to have someone who's traveled to London a lot so they could sort of navigate
the sites.
So where did you take them first?
Oh, where did we go first? We were exhausted.
We dropped our stuff off at the hostel.
We stayed at the generator, which we'll talk about, though, the funness of the hostel.
Oh, boy. Yeah, so, and then we immediately started walking. We walked towards St. Pancras.
Mm-hmm, we did. I think we were in Trafalgar Square. We did a kind of a mini walking tour. It was freezing and then it started raining.
It was. So it was not good weather the
it
first
was not
day.
So the rumors are true about the weather in London.
It was mostly good, but there was a few days where it was kind of like,
it got warmer as it progressed, but yeah, it was a little cold to start.
And then we had dinner, which was fantastic, at this pub called The Mitre. Mm-hmm. And it was just this wonderful.
I think fish and chips were like,
huge.
So you were fully immersing yourselves.
Oh, yeah.
And then you stayed at a hostel. I mean, was that kind of a shock for especially the students?
It was a shock when you had to carry your luggage up 6 flights of stairs. Yeah, because the elevator is just very slow or whatever. It was like, oh, okay, well. And then, like, the bathrooms were public, so you're sharing with everyone. The bathrooms are different. I mean, you don't have the same like water pressure, so it sometimes just didn't flush. It was interesting.
See, it's the little things you notice when you're going someplace new.
I swear, that's the culture shock that I got.
Well, you know, it's the experience of being a student, you know. Now, faculty did not have that experience. We had our own rooms, so we had our own bathrooms. But
the presidential suite?
Yeah, well, it was either too hot or too cold. At one point, my shower wouldn't turn off, so the entire room was filled with steam, and there was water dripping down the walls, and Benita walked in and said, oh, your ceiling is wet. And I said, oh, my God. So she said, well, move your laptop bag and let it drip on the bench. Yeah, it was pretty weird.
So again, you know, kind of things we just take for granted here in the States, you know, it's living in our seat of luxury
but
that we live
so
in here.
It was so fun. It was just fun to experience it that.
So that was your first day. It was just kind of getting acclimated and getting in there. So what was your first media experience?
Oh, our first media experience was actually the BBC.
Yeah, that's at BBC.
So we had it was a paid tour. So part of it was kind of easy to do because we paid for the tour before we left. Mm-hmm. So when we got there, you know, they met us in the lobby and we kind of walked through a little bit of security. They checked our bags and all of that. What was interesting was that we had zero access to the newsroom. So we could look down the newsroom, but we couldn't actually interact with anybody in the newsroom. And we couldn't take any photos because the BBC, being the largest news organization in the world, was also a cultural icon. So they were a little bit apprehensive about letting people come through the group. And we were with like a couple of other groups too. Like we weren't the only one. Mm-hmm. We were the only university, but there was like a ladies auxiliary group with just a bunch of, I believe they were slightly drunk, women.
Well, Val, is this your first time seeing a large newsroom like that?
Oh, yes.
So what were your thoughts? I mean, have you ever experienced, or did you have any idea that something like that actually existed?
I never thought it would look how it did with the newsroom. Like it's like the hive. Everyone's just buzzing away, clicking, and they're right next to each other. But like with security, it is interesting because they sometimes have to rotate their desks just so people don't know where the news reporters are. Wow. And I just think that's so interesting that these news places have a big impact on what you're
doing. Do you feel like it's because, I mean, I know they're a worldwide news organization, but they're also much closer to the party, let's just say. I mean, being in the UK and being that, and being part of the European community and being close to the place where all the hotbeds of the world news are taking place right now, do you feel like that's just changes their atmosphere and the way that they create content and the way
I
they make
they
news?
I think they got a lot on their shoulders and they have to make sure they are up to their standards and don't let anyone down and please their audience that they want. And
so did that same seriousness that you kind of experienced when you first stepped off the plane, do you experience that there as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, just it was very a limited tour. Like, you don't see as much as you want because they had security issues. And we were actually one of the last groups to have tours of BBC because they are shutting it down with the government.
Yeah, I think BBC decided to shut down the tours because of security issues. And they said, look, we just can't handle it right now. So it's better for us to reevaluate how we do these tours, because apparently they'd had some issues in the past where people in the tour group, I don't think it was anything majorly serious, but it was serious enough for them to say, we're going to go ahead and shut down the tours. And, you know, each person was like, I think it's like £15 a person. So that's a pretty nice chunk of cash they're losing out on. I mean,
right. So it must be serious.
It's serious enough that they were actually willing to go ahead and forego it.
So what else did you see at the BBC?
We got to go to different newsrooms or, I guess, production rooms. And we saw, let's see, I did a fake news report. I got to read the lines. With,
off a teleprompter?
Yeah.
Wow.
About the weather or something about
I think you did. Yeah, something about the weather. And
like an animal.
It was something like that.
Then there was actually a woman, like one of the women in the other group. She was the weather report. And she had free, like she didn't have a script. So she was just going right off the bat of the weather, and she nailed it. She did so
She was
well.
Really good, surprisingly.
It was just really fun to, like, it was just kind of like, okay, like we just winged it, and it worked out.
I mean, some of those hands-on things were really kind of fun. All the students enjoyed that a lot,
yeah,
too. And it was just
like
fun
stage,
to see it.
Yeah, and, like, one of the stages, like, they said they cut it from, like, it used to be like the ground below. And then they just, like, built it up a little so you could see that the walls didn't match. Like, some of the door was still – sorry, my foot.
No, you're
some
fine.
Of the door is, like, far away from the – how does that – the ground?
Right.
Did you see that?
Yeah, it was, like, a little half door. It's like, a little hobbit door. And they were like, well, technically we don't use it because it's just part of a door.
Yeah.
And so they sort of, like, pieced together this studio. And it was beautiful. I mean, it was old stuff, but it was kind of cool to see the way they just sort of said – we're not wasting any of this. We're just going to stick it together.
And I heard you got to participate in the filming of a show there, too.
Oh,
yeah, so that was the fake news report. And then they also got to, the fake news, then the show that we got to be. We were invited
the
as guests.
Show.
Yeah,
That was very cool because we did get to see where they filmed that with the green couch. I've never watched the show, but that's the famous green couch in there and the celebrity sit. But I saw that, or we were invited back, so, like, we got to go back into that room and then be on the outskirts of, like, the couch. Like,
So
it's a very small room.
Yeah, so they showed us this room before the one show, and so we were like, okay, it's kind of a really small room, and they sort of talked about how they angle cameras in certain ways to give the audience the illusion this room is very large, and then when they invited us back in, they had lights up. And it was like this room that was kind of, you know, really just a blah kind of metal room with an ugly green couch. All of a sudden it was like stunning
Amazing.
With purple lights and pink lights. And this couch was illuminated. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, they really
So you got a view of the illusion that they create.
Yeah. Exactly. And isn't that cool? Like, there's always an illusion when it comes to filming. When it comes
like right
to
now, we're in our super high-tech studios and not at all in an old women's dorm that was built in the 30s. Yes, all right. Yeah, we all maintain an illusion.
Exactly.
Did you get a sense at all, of the impact, the influence that the BBC has? I mean, the BBC is huge, and I don't think we have an equivalent even close to it in America. Did you really get a sense for the gravitas of how big the BBC is?
I mean, right, because I don't really watch the news on television because I think it's biased. I don't think it's like a fair view of what's going on, and BBC tries to steer away from that and try to have very unbiased opinions, and they reach a very large audience and they're successful. So clearly that's a difference between what I view as news and what's important. Like I go mostly on my phone and see the news from there, and BBC make sure that everyone's, like, don't they have their own, like, TV, like, station or something?
Yeah, they're TV, they're radio, they're online. I mean, they're just a total multimedia monster. And they're huge. I think they have, what did they say, 6,000 staff reporters? Yeah. I mean, it's massive.
I've just never seen something like that in America.
I mean, I think when Val described it as the hive, that's a really accurate description, because really there were thousands of people working at any one time doing multiple things at different times. And I mean, I think they've got the most reporters globally around the world. Mm-hmm. They've got stations, the largest news organization in the world. So, you know, I wouldn't say they're totally unbiased, because no news organization is totally unbiased.
True,
but they are. I think
they're working towards it. I mean, there's always going to be some opinion with any reporter, because it's just a person talking.
Yeah, I mean, it's all coming from a specific place. So.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was an interesting experience to see.
Did it meet your goals? I mean, you and I talked a little bit beforehand. I don't want to really use the word disappointed, but I think that you got a different view of it than you might have wanted.
Yeah, we wanted a little bit more nitty gritty. We really wanted to see a little bit more of the inside of the station, and because it was a paid tour, and because they did have a lot of security issues, we had a very sort of, I guess the word would be a very sanitized tour. It was still very important for us to see this. Obviously, it's the BBC. This is a journalism class. We need to see it. But, you know, it would have been nice if we have gotten a chance to maybe talk to a reporter, ask questions about user-generated content. You know, how is BBC sort of moving into, and they're really one of the first ones to move into this multimedia space. So to talk about that, and really our tour guides were a couple of actors who were going to be out of a job by that Sunday.
Right. They weren't answering
detailed questions.
No, and they really could tell you, here's the TV screen, that's the newsroom, don't take a photo. It was very sort of...
It was different from the other radio station we went to, Al Jazeera. We had...
At the TV station,
and we had just a very detailed, a very extensive talk with the one of the...
Executive producers. Yeah, he sat with us for 45 minutes, actually.
So let's go there next. With Al Jazeera, I know that they had made an attempt to get into the United States news market. They're here informally. It is a worldwide news service, certainly their content is accessible here. They tried to latch on and become a well-viewed news network, the equivalent of like a CNN or Fox News or something like those, and it just didn't work here. But Al Jazeera is a serious worldwide news organization, and they have a pretty heady presence in London. So I know that's why you wanted to bring the students there, to experience a different kind of news organization from a different political and cultural perspective. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. And I mean, to me, I feel like, you know, BBC is a really big one. Of course, you've got to see the BBC. But Al Jazeera is another really major news organization. It's called the CNN of the Middle East for a very specific reason. They handle news stories that maybe you wouldn't see on an American news station. So it was important for us to see that. Also, it was in the Shard, which is just this stunning,
beautiful,
architecturally gorgeous building. It was an amazing icon to look at that as well. But we really wanted to get an input on how Al Jazeera functions within London. And the executive producer was really great about telling us about how they really incorporate a lot of user-generated content. They talked about the Arab Spring. They talked a lot about the different protests around the world that they really couldn't have access to. They couldn't send reporters in, but they were able to get footage from just everyday people that were just living in the area with a cell phone. So that was an interesting conversation to have.
And did they talk about their news goals at all, or how they want people to perceive the content that they're producing? I mean, I know that they struggle with how especially Western media views Al Jazeera in general. Did they talk at all about how they're trying to break that barrier down, or did you get any kind of insight into how their process works?
We did a little bit. One of the students in my class brought up she said, this station is funded by the Qatari government. And he was like, 95% of our funding comes from there. And she's like, well, does that mean that they tell you what to air? And he's like, no. And we were sort of like, well, yes, but we're being polite, so we won't say anything. But he was very specific when he said, they shut down the U.S. offices for a couple of reasons. One, because the Qatari government said, well, since the price of oil is down, we can only fund so much, so we're going to drop the U.S. station because it's not getting as much audience members. There's not as many eyes watching it. And so they said, because Al Jazeera has a very specific connotation in the United States, it's a lot harder to maintain that type of station. Americans view Al Jazeera as a propaganda tool. They see it as a place where, maybe terrorist organizations might send information as opposed to American news organizations. So they see it in a different light. So it was a tougher crowd in the U.S. But in London and in the Middle East, it was thriving. In London, it was thriving very well. In fact, they had a it's a disaster plan where if the station in Doha, Qatar is attacked, the London station takes over 24 hours a day. And if the station in London is attacked, then the Doha station covers it. So, you know, they are well linked together.
And they're prepared. They understand, like, safety is an issue.
So, Val, you're a younger American. Did you know about Al Jazeera in advance of going there? Did you have any?
No, I didn't.
Did you know anything about them?
No, I've never heard of them. I mean, I wish I did because I think it's important to have these views and have more public listen to these stations because
different viewpoints, different perspectives.
We don't get those perspectives with, you know, the regular 7 o'clock news, 6 o'clock news. Yeah.
So I think you're experiencing something, and I want you to talk a little bit about this. That in London specifically, but I think in most other parts of the world, news is a much more multi-perspective, worldwide perspective kind of pursuit. I mean, did you start to, you'd been to the BBC, now you've been to Al Jazeera. Did you start to see that difference?
Yeah, with like how media is used. Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, definitely a different perspective when it came to just when you're getting your news, is it through the newspaper? Is it online? Is it on the television? Is it on the radio? I mean, most of the time people don't have a cars in London, they use the subway or cabs, any other transportation, so they're probably not listening to the radio as much, but at the same time, there's just these big radio stations, so they somehow still want that. They still, you know, have a need for listening to that, and I think that's interesting. I think we shouldn't lose touch of that, like a variety of different like ways to get your media,
and I don't think it's as isolated either. I think it's much more worldly.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
So I think you probably saw and heard things that would never make it into American media.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, one of the examples I think is that's very frequently given, especially about the BBC, is war coverage. Yeah. You know, as much as Americans, and I'm going to say this in a harsh way, and I don't mean it that way, Americans love their wars and the coverage therein, and it gets we don't cover it in the same way that a BBC or an Al Jazeera does. They're not as afraid to put violent footage out there because it's a reality of war.
I definitely think American news will cover it up. They'll talk about it, but they will cover it up.
They don't want people to see the harsh reality.
Not a big deal. Like, it's not us, so.
Yeah, what's interesting is that, and one of the things that Al Jazeera has been criticized for is the fact that they show war, exactly what war looks like.
Right.
And so Al Jazeera will say, well, this is what war looks like.
Is.
It's not just tanks
not
and soldiers.
It's not illusioned.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, tanks and soldiers handing candy to kids. It's way more than that. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
It's horrible. People are dying. And so they show it that way. And I think in many ways that may turn people off from Al Jazeera who are not used to that kind of content. But for the Middle East, for many countries in the Middle East, that's a reality for them. And so to them, it's like, we need to see what's happening around us and we need to know.
And we go to the movies in America and see war movies. We see movies of people getting, you know, blown up. And we think that's cool, like superheroes fighting and stuff. But then we can't understand that it's actually happening in real life.
Yeah.
And they're not afraid of that. And did they talk about that at all while you were there? I mean, did they talk about their perspective?
Not really. I think we talked about maybe not like Vice is a news organization that sort of targets more youthful audiences, and I think that they have some wacky posts, so I feel like they're more not afraid to, you know, be out there and say what, you know, what's really going on. But at the same time, every news station is different, so
So what was the difference? What did you experience at Al Jazeera that you didn't get from the tour at the BBC?
Well, we definitely had the more one-on-one conversation with the executive producer, and then I felt more just formal walking in because it was the Shard, so it's a beautiful building and they have like high security, but just even like welcoming us and saying, you know, this is what we're going to show you today. It was just a lot more
appropriate.
and in depth and just personable. Yeah,
I think the thing was the BBC treated us like tourists,
yes.
Whereas Al Jazeera was like, "Hey, you're a class, you're an academic group, so come on in." And so we had the conversation was different. Whereas BBC, there wasn't really a conversation. It was like, "Here's all these stops, all the different things we're going to do, and then bye bye, you've paid."
So what did you take anything away from it, Dr. Ali, that you were kind of surprised by, or
I expected a little bit more from the BBC tour, but other than that, I mean, you know, again, when we paid ahead of time, I kind of figured there was going to be a very specific type of tour. tour. I just was hoping that we'd have a Q&A session to talk to someone about, you know, sort of the idea of how BBC works in London and all of that globally, but we didn't necessarily get that. But, you know, you can get a lot of that information also off their website. So yeah.
Did you talk with the students before, even in the Al Jazeera side of things, did you talk to any of them about any kind of preconceived notions that they were approaching this with?
Yeah, we talked about, what's interesting is that before we left, we had four U.S. classes before we left, and with Al Jazeera, we did talk about BBC. We looked at their website, we looked at the type of news content, but what was interesting about Al Jazeera, and I'll just give you guys one example, is the word terrorist. Organizations like BBC and Al Jazeera have stopped using that word, and they actually, one of the reasons they stopped using it was that one person's terrorist, like in the United States, we use that word very liberally. I mean, everybody, if you're, you know, brown, you're doing something nefarious, you're a terrorist. But the BBC and Al Jazeera specifically had said, we stopped using that word because, you know, one person's terrorist is actually another person's freedom fighter. So that word has different connotations. And so that was a big thing to learn about, even the usage of language. Language labels people in different ways. And Al Jazeera decided to step away from that and say, we're going to call them gunmen. We're going to call them anything else, but we're not going to call them terrorists. So
yeah. Talking about language for a second, too, I think that something you experienced there, maybe not as much with the BBC, although they do have foreign language services, more with Al Jazeera, is does their approach to news, did you experience at all that it changes because they have to do it in different cultural settings and different languages with different emphasis on different stories just because they're in different parts of the world? I mean, did you see that their approach was kind of different than how we would handle things here in America?
Yeah, one of the things they talked about is that Al Jazeera in the Middle East has much more family-oriented programming. So they'll have children's programming, they'll have like more talk show type things, whereas the Al Jazeera in English language tends to be more news-focused. There are talk shows, but they're much more news-focused. And I think it's just a different population. I think they don't have the population in London that's going to want to watch Arabic language cartoons as much as you would want, you know, those kids are going to do that in the Middle East. So there was some of those programming differences. But I think that with news, even with the, whether it was in Arabic or in English, they were covering news that wasn't necessarily be covered by the BBC or even our CNNs, those type of stations.
And I think something we see a lot right now, especially with the election cycle going on, and we'll just throw this word out there, sensationalism. Do you see, and had you experience to this point, a difference in the media approach when it comes to sensationalizing stories? Or did they have a much more grounded approach to how they approach media and news in general?
Yeah, people could be, you know, excited for something, but I think mainly people are more sensitive in writing stories for, like, in England or in other countries besides America. I think people just try to pertain only what's really important in the story and not try and get too
stick to the facts without yelling opinions.
Yeah.
Although in BBC, I mean, even in Al Jazeera, they've gotten in trouble for that.
They have their wacky moments.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we get elements of that. You know, when we were at, I think it was Al Jazeera where he said, you know, we're not exactly like Fox, but at the same time, they do have their moments, and they've had some controversies.
Perfect,
they've had some controversies with some of the handling of information and what information was being presented on air versus what wasn't. So they've had some of those issues come up. So in terms of content and sensationalism, I don't think that they're running into something like a Fox that we have here, but I don't think they're necessarily, you know,
full-blown serious news.
There's a lot of elements in it that are very similar to what we have
here,
too.
Well, you want to keep it sort of exciting and sort of, like, not boring, not generic, not, I don't know. If it's not attention-grabbing, then are people going to want to view it?
Yeah, but, and I think there's still that criticism that comes from audiences, too, that it's sort of like, well, we're tired of the sensationalism, but it's still there.
What was the next stop on your whirlwind media tour?
Al Jazeera was actually the last thing we saw.
We're skipping around here.
We're skipping around, but that's okay, because I felt like the BBC and Al Jazeera were the two biggest ones, but we actually decided to, and one of the things I wanted to do is, I had a friend of mine who listened to Spectrum Radio growing up when she was growing up in London, and she said, you know, if you want to do a radio station, that's a really cool one to do, and so I contacted them. They were the first ones to contact me back and said, yes, come on over. And we went to Spectrum Radio, and it was an ethnic radio station. It's an ethnic radio station in London, and they have Urdu language, Hindi language, Arabic, Chinese language, and they do a lot of different English language, different parts of Europe as well, and they have Polish language, Russian language.
Yeah, it's very diverse.
Yeah, so they have a lot of different stations, and it was we got to speak to John Ogden, who was the network director, and he just gave us a whole sort of history of of Spectrum Radio and how radio works in London, and especially with ethnic radio. We were on another tour. They mentioned that about 300 languages are spoken in London. So it's a very diverse city. Yeah.
Yeah. We were sitting down beforehand. You talked a little bit about how it's a much more multicultural, blended hodgepodge.
Yes.
So Val, from your perspective, was this unique to you? I mean, had you ever experienced something like that where it's just
walking,
no big deal?
No, I've never experienced something where you're walking down the street and you'll see every different ethnicity like possible in one place. It's very cool to see that. I'm used to being either in Livonia where it's like a mostly white population or, I mean, Ypsilanti has a pretty decent amount of African American populations, but I don't like live here, so it's still not what I see like every day.
Yeah, one thing I noticed was the amount of halal restaurants. I mean, we have Dearborn, so I go to Dearborn all the time. But I mean, I could walk out of my the hotel, and there was like 10 halal restaurants. I mean, all around me. So there was options everywhere. So, you know, I'm Muslim and I eat halal. So it was kind of nice to see that. And
but it didn't stick out. It was just woven into the fabric of everyday life.
Absolutely.
There.
It was just an everyday thing. And I think their national food is the chicken tikka masala. So they're very multicultural, really into South Asian.
And I think that's
food,
great
so,
because
yeah.
if they're more accepting of, you know, the culture of it, they're more accepting of individuals.
Well, having friends from the UK come here, and I know that their quest for a good curry restaurant is always very, very difficult in the United States. So.
Yeah. I mean, when we were there, too, there were conversations about the elections were happening for the mayor of London, and they ended up hiring, they ended up electing a Pakistani Muslim mayor. It was the first time they'd had that. So, I mean, that was a really big deal for them. And
I didn't know that happened.
So, yeah, I mean, by the time we arrived, I think it was like the couple days after they elected him. So that was, you know, it's the diversity that we're seeing then. I'm Pakistani, so to see a Pakistani mayor of London is actually really cool.
Yeah. I jumped into your description of what Spectrum Radio is. So it's a multicultural service for the city of London, basically.
Yeah.
Lots of different languages.
Yeah, they do lots of different languages. It's an ethnic station, and they also have an online presence as well, because a lot of their stations, some of their stations will use Spectrum as just a place to, so they can get their signal out. So some of the stations are housed in other countries, but they'll use it as a place to, okay, we have this program, so we want to get that out. And so he talked a little bit about, you know, we have to be a little bit careful with who we let on air, because sometimes, you know, somebody will approach you and say, we've got this great idea for a show, could we do it? And he's like, great, you know, you can buy a 2-hour slot, no problem. But then they turn into like a propaganda machine. So he's like, we just have to be a little bit more careful about who we let on air. And we've had that happen where people start ranting about the government or people, and then we had to cut them off air.
And what he said about that is, you know, they don't get in trouble. Like the people that say those things, it's Spectrum.
He gets in trouble because he's managing all of that. So
he's definitely got to be on watch.
And everybody's got their agenda, of course, when they're going on air. But it's a great service if people are interested in different languages, people are interested in different cultures, and it's a way to tie back things back
you
home.
You could probably find anything there, for real.
Yeah. So that was your experience, Val, that you kind of felt like this was a much more wide open...
Yes. I mean, they said that even there's stations that are made by people that just... like want that they have a demand for that type of music or whatever they need, and they'll make it themselves, and it somehow gets on air and it stays there. It's no one takes it down. Like people just are very free and open with their
multiculturalism.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's cool.
I mean, there's a huge Pakistani South Asian population, and they do speak Urdu and Hindi, so it makes sense to have a station that would also have that kind of music and the news from those countries. So it makes complete sense to me to have an ethnic station like that. But
I would like that.
You know, in the U.S., we don't necessarily have as much of that kind of diversity in our radio programming.
Yeah.
So what else? So you went to Spectrum, you went to Al Jazeera, you went to the BBC. What else did you experience while you were there?
Oh, I think the students actually really loved it, but it was the London School of Communication.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Yeah, that was, it was nice because, you know, we have students here and they're seeing all these big news organizations, but then to go to a school and college and see people that kind of look like them and doing stuff that they could potentially be doing. So that
one of the students was like, I'm already going to come here. She's ready to pack her
bag. Was different about it?
Well, I think they did a huge appreciation for student artwork, and that was just really cool. It was one of the schools, so there was probably different, like, people in one had art and people in one had probably, like, the metal shop. We went to, like...
Yeah, they were doing lithography. Mm-hmm. They were doing printing.
There were
newsrooms
so
dedicated to student journalists. There was graphic design. There was people taking photographs. I mean, it was just a total... just amazing immersion of art and culture and everything coming together.
And they appreciate it, and they'll hang up everything on the walls. They had like an exhibit going on, but it was just so cool because we got to see that, and we got to see what these students are actually doing, because you don't see that a lot, you know, at a typical college, at least like a community college. Like, you're not going to see, like, people made shirts, like really cool looking shirts. People made paintings, like, that are huge on the wall, so it takes up a lot of space, and they were just, you know, showing them off, and I think
so
that's just really cool.
So they were producing work for the sake of display rather than just producing work to get a grade.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the university was decorated with student artwork. So, like, we have, you know, we'll have posters and things up here at Eastern, which is great.
Yeah.
But a lot of that comes through our marketing department. And
right.
In their case, their students were producing that.
It. Yeah.
Students were producing that work, and it was nice to see that. And, you know, we have, like, you know, I think we have the undergraduate symposium where it displays all the students' artwork and the work that they've done. This was kind of like like the everyday thing. Where they just had it all out, and
that was a little like similar to it, but this was like a much broader, much bigger scale.
And the diversity in the student body, I mean, that was what was interesting.
We saw a lot of interesting like just people being themselves, that like had like green hair, people just, I don't know, I like that people had their own individuality there. It was cool.
And different ethnic backgrounds. I mean, you know, I come from a background, I'm Pakistani, and I'm Pakistani, and so people like me, you don't see people like me very often in art schools or whatever the reason is. But it was nice to see a lot of South Asians. We saw people of African descent. We saw just different ethnic groups of students working at a school of communication and doing artwork and doing news. And it was this cool, diverse space to see that.
Do you feel like that multiculturalism was kind of directing how they were learning and how they were teaching?
Oh, yeah.
No, definitely. In fact, they talked a little bit about it. They said in the United States, your education tends to be a little bit more structured, mm-hmm. where you have lectures, you have assignments due at this time, whereas in London, one of the biggest culture shocks for students that come from America is that it's much more free form. We come here, and you guys have to learn on your own.
Yeah,
so
you're
essentially,
on your own.
Yeah, you pick out a study plan, you pick out a project that you do, and you spend a semester doing that.
So it's more guided learning than structured learning?
Yes.
Exactly.
Self-guided.
Yeah, they trust you to, you know, perform and do your own thing and, you know, succeed well. Like, I don't think they have, like, that much of a grade and that much of a, you need to do this and finish this. They're just like, here you go.
Yeah. And I
little
think
push.
In some ways, that's kind of more conducive to the way art works. Mm-hmm. I think students do something on a timeline.
If you're
and
so
say,
structured, is it really your work? Is it really like what you can do, like your best? I mean, it's hard because, of course, there needs to be some structure with any guidelines of anything. But yeah.
Yeah, but I see you smiling when you're thinking about it. It sounds like it was an attractive idea to you.
Oh, yes. I mean, I would love to go there. There's even just like a summer, like 4-week course or something like that.
Yeah.
Just learn and create. Learn and create.
Yeah. I would love to go.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it was a really interesting environment, and it was all these things coming together, and it was like, it'd be fun to teach here.
I was going to ask you from your perspective, I mean, does that style of kind of just everybody's in the room and everybody's producing
Synergy.
And you're kind of just guiding this energy around, is that attractive to you?
Oh, absolutely. It really reminded me a lot of my graduate work. So it just felt like they're doing this at the undergraduate level, and I was doing this at the graduate level, and I was kind of like, this is the way it really should be. If I'm telling students to do something every step of the way, mm-hmm. I don't feel like they're really gaining as much from that. But if students are saying, okay, I need to figure out some of this stuff on my own,
exactly.
I mean, I thought that was just a really cool way to just handle news and to handle art and all those different graphic design, all those things.
So did they give you time, Val, that you could just go out on your own and experience London as a college age woman in the big world of London? Or what did you?
It was mostly during the evenings that we had some free time, mm-hmm. because sometimes we had classes, and then the first night or the first time that we were supposed to have a free evening, we got invited to the BBC The One Show, so that kind of got taken away. But then I noticed that we would just we'd go place to place, and we'd have like 2 hours to just roam around. We'd have, you know, lunch and go find a spot that you want to eat. And so you definitely got some time to just really submerge. There was this one garden we all just sat in, like on the grass, and one of the students and I, we were doing yoga. We were just having fun. There was pigeons everywhere. We would feed the pigeons. Like, it was just a really cool experience, like just living there, not just looking at the sights, but also just like sitting there.
You were feeling the pace of life.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was feeling the difference.
I mean, it was designed really to allow students to see all the academic stuff, but then they need to immerse themselves in the culture,
yeah,
too. So get
both
on the
sides
tube
were
and
great.
Go find a restaurant and, you know.
Right. I went down, like, we went to it was sort of like the New York Times Square of
Piccadilly.
London. Piccadilly.
Piccadilly Circus.
And so we saw it during the day, and then I happened to just be back there at night, and it was just, I have a picture difference, and it's like, it's all lit up, and it's actually like a pink, like, light. I don't know how they did that, but like everything's lit up, and it's just so cool to see the day versus night of that.
So, Dr. Eiley, you had some goals going into this.
Yeah.
When you touched down in the U.S. and you've had some time now to kind of think about what happened, did you meet those goals, or did you expand upon them? How do you feel about the trip?
I felt really, really great about the trip. When we came back, I just felt like, man, I wish we had a few more days. But we really, everything we wanted to accomplish, we really, with the site coordinator here, really created a very tight itinerary.
Yeah, it was jam-packed.
Yeah, we had a lot of stuff to do. There were some spaces to go with the flow, so there were certain things that we had to drop when we got there just because of getting on the tube and going from location to location. But all the major news organizations, we got all of those. We got the information we wanted. Students were able to update their Tumblr accounts with pictures and reflections. And
that
we
was
had
a
all
great
of
way to tie in the the social media aspect too. Like, we all had to post on our Tumblrs about like the experiences that we were having, and it brought us together more, I think.
Yeah, and they had wrote reflection papers when they came back, so just about their experience on news. And that was a bit more structured in terms of, here are the reflection questions I want you to actually focus on, as opposed to just like gobbledygook, like, hey, let's.
Did you get any surprises in the answers that the students gave back to you?
No, not really. I did. You know, what was interesting was that they all sort of complained about the hotel and the bathrooms, which I was like, okay, I knew that was going to happen. But
I don't think I did.
What was it? You know, yeah, I think there's some people were very much more focused. Some people were sort of like, ah.
Yeah.
But,
now, to be fair, Val, you seem a little more earthy than the typical college student. So.
Well, thanks. I try.
But one of the things that was interesting, and Benita had warned me, didn't warn me, but told me, you know, they're going to complain a lot because they're going to be tired while they're there. And there were other students.
I got no sleep. Yeah. I don't think I slept like over 10 hours.
Lack of sleep, lack of sort of swelling feet, being tired. But when they came back and we had a moment to sort of rest, and we were all sort of like, wait a second. Man, we just experienced something, really amazing. So I think that was really, really cool. And it was my first experience with study abroad, too. So it was.
In my opinion, I think we got to see everything that we wanted to see. And had a good time.
So just from your perspective, Val, I think you're thrown into this almost chaotic kind of, you're going here to here to here to here to here.
Sure.
And Dr. Eiley just kind of mentioned that it collapses down on you when you come back. And, you know, what is something that is now sticking with you that you really, while you were experiencing, it was kind of like, oh, you know, I'm doing this. But now it's like, wow, I got to do this.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
I know.
Definitely, thank you. Yeah, that was a good one. Definitely getting enough sleep because I mean, my health went down and I got a little sick and I noticed I'd just be, you know, cranky or whatever. But definitely getting enough sleep is important to me. I want to try and get a better schedule. But also hydrating myself. We had to walk very, very far, and I hydrate myself as much as I can, but you don't realize how much your body needs it until you're just like really exerting yourself. We'd walk like 10 miles a day. Like, it was a pretty
it's a walkable city. I mean, that's what it's designed
to be. Not complaining at all. It was just it was good to stay. I had drank tea. I was just very detox and focused on my health there.
What's your future plan for this program, Dr. Eiley?
You know, I plan on doing it again in the summer. It was pretty successful, so we will try to do it again. Hopefully we get 10 students to want to join us again. So that's the goal. Originally the plan was that we were going to do 6 days in London and 2 days in Paris, but the cost was a little bit high. So in order to make the cost much more affordable for students, we just decided to keep it everything in London. So we're going to stick with that. We won't move to Paris. So that's the plan. Hopefully every year we're going to have to fill up the BBC since the BBC is no longer doing tours. You know, I may include Vice and the Twitter and BuzzFeed since they are major employers in the area and they're major news organizations as well. So, you know, find ways to incorporate them.
Maybe go to like a museum or something. Well, we went to the British Library and that was a very cool experience.
Yeah, that was fun. The British Library requires a full day and we just didn't have a full day for them. So we got to see the major exhibits that we wanted to see. We saw some mummies and some of the students wanted to go see stuff on Japanese artwork and they got to see that. But, you know, unfortunately, because it's only 8 days, there's only so much we can do. So there were certain things where we just saw like maybe an hour of and we had to get out. So the British Museum was one of those.
Yeah.
And Val, from your perspective, I know you're already here as a student at Eastern. So you made your choice to come to Eastern. But did this kind of solidify for you that coming to Eastern was a good decision because you got to experience something like this?
Yeah, I think it definitely was affordable for me just because of like some college tuition rates are just so high. So like even... you know, coming here and having like the advantage of a scholarship, it still is a little pricey. So you have to make sure that you do have enough money going into the trip. And I think I was able to pull it off with like the prices and as well as just the people, because Dr. Ali, she rocked it. Aww. She was so great as our professor. And like the people I met, I made friends for life, I feel like, because we just had this experience of that you don't normally get. And yeah, I'm really glad I could.
Yeah, I mean, it was great to sit with students and chat with them about their experience and their life experiences and what they thought of the trip. And, you know, we had some oddballs in the group, and that's okay, because when you have 10, they're going to have a couple that are a little bit odd.
We're all a little odd.
Yeah, so it worked out. I think that there was enough differences in personality that it melded well together.
Yes,
so.
Yes.
Well, cool. Thanks, Dr. Ali. Thank you so much for coming in and doing this today. And Val, thanks for taking time out of your busy student schedule to come on up here and chat
about this.
I'm glad you were able to have this experience, and thanks for sharing it with us. I know we're going to put some stuff up along with this audio recording in regards to the things you've experienced. We'll get some content for me to throw up there. But is there somewhere you can learn more about the trip or about the program or just, in general, about you, about life?
Yeah. So Eastern Michigan has a study abroad link on their website. So if you go to the study abroad website, there will be a link to our London trip. It'll be a part of the included part of the study abroad schedule. In addition, you can go to the Communication Media and Theater Arts website, and there will be a link as well, probably to my Tumblr account, where I show all the pictures, and there's and it'll be in our year end review as well for the departments. So
also Boone Hall Extended Programs is where you can go to actually talk to someone, meet with Benita Goldman.
Yeah, so there's an office in Boone Hall as well, so students can get access and talk to Benita or any of the, probably Benita, and she'll schedule them.
Yeah, Eleonora, I don't remember her last name. But.
So next year I have a homework assignment for you too, because this is a class, but I would love for you to next year have a goal of providing us content while you're there. That would be great. I think that really opening it up to a real world, this is media happening in world time, a real time experience, I think would be great for you, great for the students. So let's have
great.
A goal of doing that for next year.
Let's do it. Awesome.
Thanks for your time. I'm Patrick. This is 89.1 WEMU. As always, you can find more about us at WEMU.org.